You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 27th, 2022, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Devin Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone.
How is everyone?
Good, good, good.
Not
good,
bad. Good. Recovering.
You're recovering from what?
Oh.
From surgery.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's right.
I had surgery last Thursday, and I'm feeling almost 100% now. I'm definitely have, my appetite is back. I had no appetite for 2 days. I was super queasy post-anesthesia.
Ooh.
I'm not quite as weak as I was. I was very weak the first few days. I was sleeping an awful lot. And my head felt really buzzy and just off. Man, anesthesia sticks with you for a while.
Oh, yeah.
It's no joke.
That's not normal, though. It sounds like you have more of an extreme.
Pretty normal for total anesthesia. I mean, it's why they give you in your discharge instructions, like, don't operate. You cannot drive today. You shouldn't shower until tomorrow. And even then, you should take it easy. They say I couldn't lift anything more than 5 pounds. I definitely remember like 2 days after I got a new carpet cleaner and I got so excited and I cleaned some like spots that Killer had left on the carpet and it exhausted me. I needed a nap after cleaning the carpet.
Well, you know what, Bob, you know what part of the reason is. So it definitely gets worse with age. And that's just, you know, the brain.
Oh, yeah. If the last time you went under, you were young, you probably wouldn't.
But there's some pharmacological reasons for that too. And again, I don't know exactly what drugs they gave you or how much or whatever. But when you get
a lot
of drugs for that are sedating, because you had prolonged anesthesia, you've been in the hospital for a while getting those kinds of medications. Some of them are fat soluble. So what happens is they give you enough to have a clinical effect. So there's a certain amount in your blood. But in order to achieve that, a lot of it gets distributed into your fat. And then over days and weeks, that the medications come out of your fat back into your blood. So even though you're not taking the medications anymore, it could take days and days for it to clear it out of your system.
Some of my aftercare said 2 weeks to be careful about this kind of stuff. And granted, for me, it was about 2-3 days. But I mean, I remember I couldn't really watch TV. Like, I was like, oh, I'm going to have a couple days off. I'm just going to lie about and watch TV. And I was like,
I can't focus.
It's like,
my eyes are crossing.
But to be fair, I was only under for an hour and a half.
Yeah, that's not too much.
So I didn't have terrible anesthesia, but I do think I was propofol and I had Versed, which, you know, is like a woohoo anti-anxiety medication, and a fair amount of like Zofran and Pepcid, like things to keep me from barfing, thank goodness, because I didn't barf. But I do think that there are different anesthesia cocktails that for different purposes. And so, you know, if people are remembering, oh, when I had my colonoscopy, it wasn't like that. I don't know if it's quite the same.
That's like conscious sedation.
That's what I thought. It's not like the hardcore stuff. Like I had a sore throat for 2 days.
They intubated you.
Yeah.
Well, luckily they didn't do full intubation. They did this secondary thing that just like, it's supra epiglottal instead of going through your epiglottis, but it still carves up your throat.
I
was like, oh God. Fun times.
I'm glad you're doing well. I'm glad everything came out right.
Yeah, you sound great.
So we don't often do this, so I have no shame about doing this whatsoever. We're going to do a segment of a couple of things of shameless promotion before we get to the news items. The first thing is that we have some shows coming up. Jay, you want to talk about them?
Yeah, we have a lot of stuff coming up, Steve. So we will be in Arizona on July 15th and 16th. On both of those dates, we'll be doing an extravaganza. On the 15th, we'll be doing an extravaganza in Phoenix. And on the 16th, we'll be doing an extravaganza in Tucson. We also have two private shows, one in Phoenix and one in Tucson. Those dates and times, literally, by the time you hear this, they'll probably be on the website. So go take a look. And if not, they'll be there very, very soon. You can go to theskepticsguide.org/events to see all this information.
Now, for the private shows, we're doing something a little bit different. So I want to mention that. Normally, you record a 2-hour show, right? And there's a little bit of chit-chat around it. But basically, you're seeing us record a full 2-hour show episode of the show. Now we're starting to do an enhanced private show, a private show plus. We're still branding it, but it's something like that, where it's going to be 3 hours. It's going to be not 2 hours, but 3 hours. We'll still be doing a live show in the middle of it, but we're going to be doing other things just for the live audience. There's going to be a lot more interaction. We're going to be experimenting with different games and other events, and, you know, George might do some music or whatever. It's going to be an expanded event with a lot more, you know, interactive stuff going on and interaction, hanging out with us. So we're going to see how that goes. So yeah, so keep an eye out for that. And don't forget, for the extravaganzas, we also have VIP tickets where you get to spend an hour with us either before or after the show, depending on the schedule of the venue. You get extra swag. You get, you know, to take pictures with us and stuff like that. So if you're not going to the private shows and you want some VIP time, that is an option for the extravaganzas as well.
Oh, and you get the best seats in the house.
And you get the best seats.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. And so here's the other half of our shameless self-promotion is our second book just launched. So not published, but it's publishing September 27th, but you can now pre-order it. This is The Skeptic's Guide to the Future.
Oh, yeah. Whoa, that's such a cool title, Steve.
It is. Bob, Jay, and I are the authors on this one. We had so much fun writing this book.
Oh, my God.
And we learned an incredible amount. And, you know, as much as we thought, like, oh, we're steeped in all of these topics, just doing the research
weren't.
For the book, it just takes you to the next level, right?
There's right,
so
exactly.
Much more the next, I actually changed
my mind. Just a new layer
mind.
In that onion.
I changed my mind on some of these technologies based upon the research that we did. I
mean, sure.
It was really profound. So a lot of fun. I think the book came out very, very well. We'll have the link on the show notes. We'll have the link on the SGU site. It's grandcentralpublishing.com. And look for The Skeptic's Guide to the Future. And you can pre-order it. You can pre-order it pretty much everywhere, both the hard copy, the Kindle version, and the audiobook. So there will be an audiobook. I'll be recording that over the summer. So all of those can be pre-ordered. We really, if you feel like you might be buying this book, we really encourage you to pre-order it because that helps us get over that threshold to maybe get on a bestseller list, which of course would really help promote the book. So we would definitely appreciate it if you pre-order your copy. That will help us a lot. So. And I think the cover is totally awesome.
Oh, my God. I love it. It's my new background on my phone.
Steve, I was going to get that tattooed to my face. You think that's going too far or what?
Far enough. Just do one cheek. One cheek.
Back, lower back.
The lower back?
Or maybe a scapula? I would do a scapula tattoo. Yeah. Yeah, so check that out. We're really excited about that.
Steve, now don't forget, there is one more thing. Nexus 2022. It's a lock, everybody. Remember, I think I said last week, or this could have been on our live stream, I said we weren't 100% sure. Now I'm 100% sure. We are definitely doing Nexus 2022. It will be the first weekend of August. That's August 5th and August 6th. And we have a keynote, not a keynote speaker, a keynote situation. You ready to hear this? The keynote situation is that Bill Nye will be having a discussion with David Copperfield.
Oh, whoa.
That's right, Copper.
That's right, Copper.
Oh my gosh, yeah, I'm so excited.
Good try. That's good try, Kara.
Awesome. We interviewed, I know, you keep working on that accent.
No, there. I intentionally didn't do that. That's right, Copper. Because this needed something louder and more exciting.
Okay.
So you guys might remember we interviewed David 6 months ago, middle of the summer, I think it was.
Approximately.
It's hard to tell. The pandemic has destroyed my ability to tell time.
I think it was last fall.
And we had a great time talking to him. He was a ton of fun to talk to.
He was
one
of those great
people. He has, you know, an endless number of stories because he's been doing something amazing for so long that he literally, like, we had to like stop the interview because we didn't have any more time. But we loved talking to him, and that was the impetus for asking him to speak at Nexus. And he, you know, he very generously said that he would be happy to do it. And, you know, Bill is now involved with Nexus formally, and Bill is going to talk to him. So the two of those guys are going to have a really fun conversation. That's our keynote. It's a keynote situation that we would like you to enjoy. So you can go to nexus.org, NECSS.org, for all the details that you need to sign up. Now, keep in mind, we're filling in our speaker list as we go, and we have a theme this year. And the theme is Navigating the Misinformation Apocalypse. Yeah. So we will be hitting some themes here during the conference about how do science communicators deal with misinformation? How should the general public deal with misinformation? How do we deal with it? Because it's everywhere, coming from all directions, and that's what we hope to answer during this conference. So please join us.
We are doomed.
And did you mention that it's an all-digital conference?
Steve, did you know that Nexus 2022 is all digital? It's live streaming. You can watch this conference literally from anywhere you want in the world.
In your underwear.
Right. You know, you could be eating cereal as you're watching it. So the cool thing is you could get your ticket and then you could watch the conference for up to like 6 months. Because it's just there online whenever you want it. You can watch it live. If you can't make it, you don't have to watch it live. You can watch it basically whenever you want. But if you want to see it live with us, it'll be on August 5th and 6th of this year.
All right. Thanks, Jay. All right, guys, let's move on to some news items. And Jay, you're going to start with redefining the second. So this is another in our series of news items about measurements and stuff. Whenever there's a significant update to measurements, we like to talk about it. This time it's the second.
This one has a really cool history to it. There's so much more here than I could cover. Look, scientists are about to do something big to something very small. Right? Seconds.
Hi-oh. Might seem
small, right? They're small, Kara, but they're important. The second is important. So they're going to change the definition of the second. And I don't mean like we're going to call it something else. They are refining the accuracy of the second. And let me tell you the story behind it. Now, historically, people would track time by the Earth's movement. This is what people have been doing for thousands of years. The sun's relative position would change in the sky, right? And since the Earth's rotation is slowing, which it factually is, scientists knew that they had to measure time in a way that was considered to be 100% constant, right? Because the Earth's rotation is slowly slowing down, that means that the amount of time it takes the Earth to rotate is changing. And that's not good when you're tracking seconds and when seconds or even hundredths of seconds or thousands of seconds are important to do scientific measurements. So for example, Earth's slowing rotation lost 3 hours of time in the past 2,000 years. Now I get that might not seem like a lot, but to science, it's intolerable. Like, scientists can't stand that. It's not a predictable measure of time because, you know, 1 second is changing if you're measuring it via the rotation of the Earth. So I recommend that you read some history of the way that humans have been tracking time and how time tracking came to be because it's fascinating. But to give you a tiny little bit of information, before 1967, the second was considered 1/86,400th of a day. That was okay. Basically what you needed to know. And all this led scientists back in 67 to change how we measure time by looking. Now, instead of saying we're going to use the Earth or astronomical ways of defining how long a second is, we are going to use atoms, right? Like an atomic clock. I'm sure you've heard of the term atomic clock. Well, what the hell does that mean? Oh, yes. What is an atomic clock? Scientists needed something back then that was predictable and more constant than the rotation of the Earth. So they used the motion of atomic particles because they never wear out, right? Atoms don't wear out and they never change their properties. Atoms are going to behave the way that they are at the speed that they're going to behave under normal conditions, and that's it forever until the universe ends. So from a scientific point of view, they are the perfect way to measure time using atoms and using the movement of atomic particles. So they ended up using something called cesium, which, you know, it's an atom. Could also
it's
be
an element.
Ion. It's an element.
Yeah, it's weird to say it's an atom.
Yeah, you're right. Element. It's an element made of atoms. Okay. Yeah, so because exactly. because cesium, they have a heavier atomic weight and its resonance frequency was easier to study and track. They used microwaves to excite the cesium atoms to emit a flash of light at regular intervals, and those regular intervals were the movement of the atom itself. They had instruments that could pick up the flash of photons and measure time using these regular flashes that came from the atom when they hit them with microwaves, right?
Right, so like 9.2 billion flashes in a second.
Yeah.
How do you count something? Like, how do you have the resolution to count something like that?
One, two, oh, start over.
Okay, I think I can give a more technical explanation than that. It's tricky, and it's hard to find sources that really give it a good description, but here we go. Cesium-133 atoms essentially exist in two energy states. Let's just say a low energy and a high energy state. So they use a magnet to separate the two so that you have a pure stream of low energy state cesium atoms. They then expose it to microwaves at precisely the right frequency, that 9.2 billion cycles per second, which bumps the low energy cesium atoms into a high energy state. They then use another magnet to remove any remaining low energy cesium atoms, and they count the high energy cesium atoms, which then feeds back into the microwave generator so they can fine tune the microwaves to the precise frequency that maximizes the number of high energy cesium atoms hitting the detector, right? So that's how they make that frequency extremely, extremely precise. Here's where it gets a little tricky, and it's hard to find an exact description. I think there's different types of clocks, so they may use different methods, but a common method at this point is then to use a quartz crystal, like a regular quartz timekeeper, and they use the resonant frequency of the microwaves to fine-tune the oscillations of the quartz crystal. In one description, where they make it 10 million cycles per second. And then you could just use regular electronics to measure those 10 million cycles per second. Basically, every 10 million cycles, it spits out a pulse. That's 1 second. So, but I know there's a fountain cesium clock at NIST, which uses a slightly different method. It gets a little technically complicated at that point, but it's essentially they're fine-tuning the resonance frequency of the microwaves to the cesium atoms by measuring how many of those atoms get bumped into the higher energy state. And then they have to feed that back into some kind of counter, which could, in one type, uses just a regular quartz crystal to measure time.
All right, so guys, the International Bureau of Weights and Measures, which I think is pretty cool, they ended up facilitating the official change in measuring the second using these cesium atoms back in 67. But keep in mind that astronomical time and atomic time still needed to be synced up, since we're living on Earth and we need our day and night and our 24-hour cycle to still make sense, even though it's a little bit longer than 24 hours. They still had to sync them up. So what scientists did is they add a leap second to the atomic time roughly every year and a half. And this accounts for Earth's slowing spin.
And this is why, like, our GPSs work.
Yeah, well, right. If they didn't sync things up like this, lots of stuff wouldn't work, right? So they have to sync it up, because we are bound to the Earth and we live on the Earth. So therefore, we need our astronomical timekeeping and our atomic timekeeping to jive with each other. So we have these fix it little doodads that we do every year and a half or so. So updating the measure of a second is happening because scientists have created new and very sensitive instruments called optical atomic clocks. These work like the cesium time tracking method, but the new version can detect much faster atomic movement. So they can use many different atoms today, or ions, with the latest equipment that they've come up with, like strontium and mercury and aluminum, to list a few. Now, none of them have been picked as the new default atom or ion, because all of this is still in the laboratory. It's not ready for prime time yet. You know, they haven't dialed everything in yet. The equipment takes many people to operate. You know, it's not simple enough or elegant enough to use as the new standard yet. The equipment takes many people to operate and is simply not elegant enough to use as the new standard yet. The equipment needs to be perfectly stable, as an example. It has to be shielded from the Earth's magnetic field. You know, they need to chill the atoms or ions to near absolute zero. This slows them down, and then they shoot lasers at them, and they're searching for the best wavelength of light that works best with each different atom or ion, right? Because they want that really specific wavelength of light that's going to make the atom do something like give a predictable reaction. Like, it might create photons, or, you know, might give off a certain amount of energy at some point that they can detect.
Yeah. So essentially they're using atoms that have a resonance frequency in the optical range rather than the microwave range. So that resonant frequency is about 50,000 times greater than for cesium atoms. And therefore, they're 50,000 times more precise.
A second type of laser called a femtosecond laser frequency comb.
Baby.
This is what Bob uses in the morning to comb his hair. A femtosecond laser frequency comb. This laser is used to read the wavelengths of laser light that excites the atoms or ions. So this process can detect and measure these pulses of light 100,000 times faster than the cesium clocks from 50 years ago.
Whoa, that's significant.
Right. So nice. That right there is how much more accurate the clocks you know, the atomic clocks are today than the ones that they created back in 67 or earlier. This means that these new methods of measuring time are just much more accurate and much more in line with scientific precision, which is what we want here. So after all this, I would expect at least Kara or Evan to say, hey, why do we need the second to be so much more precise? Who cares?
GPSs. Hey, why do we need the second to be so much more precise?
Thank you, Evan. I'm really glad that you're absorbing this. One reason is that time is affected by gravity.
Is it?
And you might go, okay, so what? Well, time moves slower when you are near a planet or a black hole, right? So the closer you are to a gravity well, anything that is producing gravity, could be a planet, could be a sun, could be a black hole. Time is not constant in our universe because of this. Time is constant to the, you know, to your relative position, but time is moving faster and slower all over the place in our universe because of gravity. Because atomic clocks are affected by gravity and their time tracking will reflect this, this means that they can detect things like gravitational waves or dark matter. Think about that, right? Because they're so sensitive to changes in gravity, these new atomic clocks, they can detect gravitational waves. That is freaking amazing. This was proven back.
Will they be used for that purpose?
I absolutely think so, Kara. Yeah. I mean, I think that they're so sensitive.
Wait a second. How does that work?
I'm going to tell you right now, Bob. I'm going to tell you right now. Check this out. This was proven back in 2015. So physicists at NIST were working on these optical atomic clocks, and they noticed that the time was not consistent on all of their clocks that were situated around Boulder, Colorado. Right, they have multiple versions of these clocks that they're working on and that they're testing, and they were very close to each other, all in the same city, but the time that they were representing was off, and they're like, "What's going on? What the hell is this?" Huh. So it turns out that all the clocks were at slightly different altitudes.
Yes,
right.
The altitude matters.
So why does that matter? A clock that was 1 centimeter higher than another one that was a few miles away was reading time differently. Because it was farther from the center of the Earth, which means that it was farther from the center of the gravity well that it was pulling on it. 1 centimeter, guys. And these clocks recorded the difference.
All right.
Of 1 centimeter in altitude. Bob, think about that.
I already have. I talked about it like a year and a half ago on the show.
What did you think? What was your reaction, though?
You said gravitational waves, Jay.
Yes. They said, Bob, the article said that these things could detect gravitational waves and dark matter.
Bob, I think this is what Jay's talking about. So I'm seeing a study from 2015. Using atomic clocks to detect gravitational waves, they say that if they're pointing out theoretically that if you had an array of atomic clocks distributed along the Earth's orbit around the sun, that would have the sensitivity to detect the time dilation effect of a megahertz gravitational wave, such as those emitted by supermassive black holes and binaries. So you would have to set up an instrument using these clocks to detect it.
Yeah.
You're detecting the difference, you know, between an array of these atomic clocks, but they are sensitive enough that they can detect something of the magnitude, the relativity effect of the magnitude of a gravitational wave.
So I'm just trying to think how a stretched space-time by a thousandth of the diameter of a proton, how that is going to affect an atomic clock.
The simultaneous measurement of clock rates at different phases of a passing gravitational wave provides an attractive alternative to the interferometric detection of temporal variations in distance.
Yeah, it sounds like it's not the clock itself. It's the clock relative to the clock next to it.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. But, okay, all right. I get that. But, I mean, that just came out of left field for me.
They're saying that it's possible that they will have finalized this way of measuring time probably by the second half of this decade. You know, I don't think they're in a big rush. I think they want to wait until they nail it, of course.
They have time.
Yeah. But we will be someday very soon. We will be measuring the second now with more precision, you know, once that they master this technique. So nothing has changed other than the fact that it's more accurate and that it can do a lot of cool things that piss Bob off.
Okay. All right. Thanks,
guys.
Jay.
Love you, Jay.
Kara, what is NFT medicine? What is it?
What the hell?
Non-fungible token medicine.
No way.
You guys. Okay.
Is that right?
This is an evolving story that really has kind of hit the news cycle within the last week or so. And, you know, each article is adding something to it and things are changing in the background every day. So if you're Googling this on Saturday. We recorded this the previous Wednesday. So just keep that in mind. This is an evolving story.
So much has changed.
Okay. So I think in order to really dive deep into it, we don't have time to do the deepest ever dive of like what an NFT is and what blockchain is and what cryptocurrency is, because these things are all related. But I do think it's important to like make sure we know what those terms basically at least refer to. So is anybody here confused about the concepts of NFTs, blockchains, crypto?
I know barely enough.
Okay. But you, and dangerous. I think that's how most people feel. And it's like, yes, we could probably do a super deep dive into it, but if we know barely enough, we might be okay. So a blockchain is a database that's distributed. It's shared amongst a bunch of nodes of a computer network. So it's, think about that. It's a database that's spread out a bunch, multiple nodes, usually like sometimes dozens or hundreds or thousands of machines. And then blockchains, as we know them very often for their role in crypto, things like Bitcoin, because they're able to make decentralized records of transactions. So it's not just in one place, it's across all these different nodes, which makes it really, 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 really secure and have high fidelity, right? So that's not the only thing that blockchain is used for, but we know it well within the context of cryptocurrency. But another context is the NFT, the non-fungible token, which, and I have some concerns and questions even about the huge boom in NFTs, because I think that opens the door to a lot of scammy activity online. But basically, an NFT is a unit of data. That's really all it is, and you can't interchange it. So I love an article that I once read referred to an NFT like the necklace you made for your grandma out of macaroni at summer camp. There can only ever just be one. And you can give it to her and she can go, I don't like this, I'm going to sell it to somebody else or give it to somebody else. But it's never going to be replicated. You can make a knockoff, but there's only one macaroni necklace. Does that make sense? So an NFT is a digital version of that. And so far we've heard about it, like photos, videos, audio, like albums on NFT. There's even Mila Kunis and the guy, I think, who invented Ethereum. They made like a TV show about stoned cats. There's like a whole thing. And like, very often this stuff is paid for with cryptocurrency, and it's ungodly expensive. Like, that's another amazing thing about NFTs is that they represent real world items. They can, because they're like tokens, but very often that's what they are. They are tokens. I mean, by definition, they're non-fungible tokens. There is like this inflated price that goes along with a lot of them. What's that recent artwork that sold? You guys saw that, right? $91.8 million.
What?
Most expensive NFT ever sold in December of 2021 by an artist who goes by the pseudonym Pack. Mm-hmm. It was called The Merge. $91.8 million. So like, yeah. And that's not a one-off, you guys. Like, if you start reading and getting into the weeds on what NFTs are, how much they cost, who's paying for them, there's a lot of money and a lot of potential for scamming. I say all that to preface this very interesting business, I guess you could call it that, business called MetaDocs. Now, MetaDocs were like, hey, we're going to be a group of internet famous doctors, and we're going to offer medicine as an NFT.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God.
And this sparked a lot of concern. Yes, first of all, very expensive. In their white paper, they were listing it as 0.2. Yeah, so that's at the time, it was about $570 to buy the NFT. But if I were to sit here and tell you everything the NFT got you, I would be lying, because all of this is still somewhat theoretical. It feels a little like the Fyre Festival to me. Like there was, there was a white paper and there's like a website and everybody's talking about it, but it doesn't exist yet.
It's got massive social media momentum.
Massive. But it doesn't actually exist yet. And so we don't really know what it holds. What we do know is that when the white paper was first published, there were a lot of doctors on board. And these doctors were mostly, they kind of came from every different discipline, and they came from all over the sort of expertise and credential spectrum. But it seems like there was one thing that they all had in common, and that was that they were either Instagram or TikTok famous. So these doctors came with, I wouldn't call it cachet, but I would call it a following. And the idea here was, okay, it was pitched as a way to, quote, cut through the red tape of traditional medicine. I guess that means for rich people. That's the only way that I can kind of make sense of this. Because if you can't afford this, then what good is cutting through red tape? And the idea here is that this would be a non-fungible token that you could purchase using crypto of these doctors. They are represented by cartoons. If you want to look this up online, you'll see pictures of the cartoons. They are kind of scary looking. I personally would feel really uncomfortable in the metaverse, for example, discussing a legitimate medical concern with one of these like creepy little avatars of a physician.
But what then, do you get? I mean, what I know it's an NFT, but is it actually providing medical services?
Right. So here's the real problem. They don't have a telehealth credential. And this kind of came out after people started reading about this. They were like, wait. Metadocs are a bunch of doctors that are selling their presence, their interaction for a pretty high dollar of crypto on what they want eventually to be the metaverse. They want this to be like a Web 3.0 kind of interaction, but they can't legally dispense medical advice. So basically, they're talking about AMAs, they're talking about video chats, but they're now all of a sudden, as people are asking more and more, cleaning up the white paper, removing descriptions on the Discord server, removing original videos that were kind of talking a big game about how this was going to disrupt the healthcare industry because they can't make claims about the person who buys the NFT being a patient, the provider actually providing medical advice, or treating the patient. They say that's all kind of where they want to go. They hope it'll evolve into what they called a virtual clinic in the metaverse where a patient can wear a haptic suit and be remotely examined in VR by a physician. Ooh. And although that sounds like a really cool idea, A, the technology isn't there yet,
and B,
a lot of physicians have come out saying, I am not comfortable with this ethically, and I'm very concerned. I'm not going to say this is a scam, but I'm concerned that this has all the trappings of a scam. And so this is where I wanted to – this is why I wanted to talk about this on the show, because I wanted to open this up to a conversation with you guys, like, what are your concerns? Do you see this potentially being the future of medicine someday? Do you feel like Metadocs went about this the wrong way? Because it was like kind of all glitter. It was all marketing and the content's really not quite there. Like, here's a quote from a physician at University Hospitals in Cleveland. Quote, there are a lot of hype words thrown around and they don't really convey any meaning. They don't guarantee that you could access the doctor your problem needs or even one that has completed medical training. Because that's another problem here. They found out that since all of this was kind of first announced and becoming public on the internet, multiple doctors have left. A couple of them have said that their names were included in the press materials without ever consulting them. A couple of them were physicians who were still in residency, so they're not fully licensed yet, or they're not fully board certified yet. And here's another quote from a doctor who's not involved in Metadocs who said, if you're incentivizing doctors to join this project based on their community of followers or you're generating profit for token holders, it's hard to reconcile that with the ethos of care. And so a lot of people are likening this unto sort of Dr. Oz on an older platform, television, promoting all sorts of supplements and unproven things, kind of using his clout as a physician to build a following and then to sell stuff. And they're worried that that's sort of, this is like a Web 3.0 version of that. So what do you guys think?
On first blush, it sounds completely horrible. I mean, first of all, it's confusing, which is part of the problem here, because I think your average person would be like, huh, what's happening? Like, you want me to like buy time talking to a cartoon version of a doctor that's going to do what, you know, and if they're like basing some of their ability to give treatments to people or to come up with a prognosis on someone with haptic feedback, that could be 20 years away.
Exactly. So, that's no, they're nowhere near that. And so what they keep saying is that it's about offering information and education. And so, like, based on what you just said, Jay, I love this. So there's a BuzzFeed News blew a lot of this open, but there are like a ton of other articles around it now. But I scrolled down to the bottom of the BuzzFeed News article and looked at the comments. You guys are going to love this. The first comment, there are three that come up right at the top that I'm just obsessed with. The first comment, those are certainly all words. Kind of how we're all feeling. Nice. The next comment, dystopian as hell, which I think we're all kind of feeling that too. But then another comment, which offers the alternative view. Not really sure why this is an issue other than clickbaiting the NFT hate. I'm curious to see if 10 years from now we're all using NFTs and crypto for everything, lol. BuzzFeed, come on, you guys need to focus on more important things and actually use your audience to make an impact. So you've got sort of the other side of it, which is like, crypto is, you know, is the future and you guys are just Luddites because you don't really get it yet. But of course, then there's responses to that, like, calm down. Crypto is polluting the environment. It's never going to catch on the way you want it to. You know, let's all take a breath. So it's an interesting slice of a microcosm of an industry, this sort of Web3 industry that a lot of people are genuinely, legitimately hopeful that blockchain is the future. But I worry that this is very, very preemptive.
And who wants to be the guinea pig, right?
A lot of people. That's the crazy thing. Like, when you start to dig into these rabbit holes, reading about crypto and NFTs, you find out that people are spending so much money to get access to artwork, to get access to TV shows that only exist on the blockchain, to get access to things other people can't have. I wouldn't be surprised if they could raise a ton of funding for this.
So my concern is that it's not even the NFT aspect of it. It's the service that's being provided, which is not a consult, but
right.
Sort
it's ethically
of is.
Nebulous. What
it's
is
in,
it?
Yeah, it's in that gray zone. There's a reason why we don't do this. Uh-huh. Either you're giving a full medical consult or you're not.
Right.
And that middle zone is dangerous because you're not getting all the information you need. You know what I mean? Like, so are you reviewing their medical records? Are you doing a full history? Or do you know what all their allergies are? Do you, you know, unless you do a full evaluation, you can miss things. You can give bad advice.
Right. Like, and when you're talking to a lot of people, like you do on Science-Based Medicine, we do here on the SGU, you see it on the nightly news, or even sometimes all the time on social media, but sometimes it's done ethically, where physicians are saying, here's a topic. This is what the evidence shows. This is the way we tend to approach it. This is general information to educate you. It's not intended to treat any specific illness or to be personalized, but this is personalized. So this is one person. That's where things get scary.
But I think the use of NFTs, I mean, there's the whole issue of they're bad for the environment. It uses up too much energy. It's not sustainable. But that aside, having some kind of a digital ownership system could be useful for things even beyond just owning artwork or memes or whatever. Yeah. There's an article from earlier this year where they talked about using NFTs or some system like that so that patients can own their own health information.
Right, like your DNA.
Like sell it in a health information exchange. Oh, you want to use my information in a study? Oh, I own it. Let's talk about what you're going to pay me for it, you know?
I could see that with like a 23andMe with you know, where it brings the power back into the hands of the patient.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it's intended to do.
Yeah.
So we'll see. We're still, obviously, it's early days. You know,
but that there...
People will explore everything, but that's different. I'm concerned about the, is this a consult or isn't it? Is this telehealth?
Right.
Then do telehealth. But, you know,
I know. I almost feel like, don't you feel like they're solving a problem that doesn't exist?
What's the necessity? Yeah. Right. Yeah. What's driving this?
I mean, isn't it crystal clear that these doctors are trying to get rich off of this stupid NFT hype?
Well, that's like, what I think. And so here is a quote from the guy who started this, or he's very high up. His name's Jorbochny. He's an ear, nose, and throat doctor, an Odlin.
ENT.
He refers to himself as a, quote, medical infotainment provider.
Oh,
what is that?
And he said,
that's like someone who sells oil from the back of the carnival.
Well, I think he's a licensed, I think he's a licensed and credentialed physician who also does a lot
of. I'm just saying what it sounds like.
Well, he does a lot of infotainment on social media. right? Oh, so he says, quote, value isn't just medical care. Our deliverable is connecting people with these doctors for a value of whatever they want to talk about or connect with.
What the hell does that even mean? What, do you want to talk about the latest movie they saw? I want to go to a specialist that can help me with the very specific thing that's wrong with me.
I know. It's right? very strict. I mean, I can imagine that there's someone listening who's like maybe struggled with chronic disease, who has been in the medical system for a long time and has struggled with a lot of the kind of negative trappings that we often hear about within the like the constraints of our medical system, not enough time, too short of sessions, too short of appointments, that could say, oh my God, I would love to be able to just sit and talk to a physician and really, like, really engage with them and ask them a lot of questions, because I often feel like I can't do that when I'm seeking care, utilizing traditional medicine. The sad thing is, I don't think that's what this is, and I don't think this would offer that person that. I think that all this would do is open up potential ethical Pandora's box.
Yeah. Sounds dodgy.
It's worrisome. It sounds super dodgy. That's why I said at the beginning, and maybe I shouldn't have sort of biased it with, like, the more I read about this, the more I think this is like Fyre Festival. But it just has that vibe to me, and I'm concerned about it.
Yeah. Let's see where it goes.
Me too. Yeah. So like I said, evolving story. Almost every day there's a new article that says, you know, they took down this explanation off their website. So yeah, but their website is still up and you can kind of see about it yourself, and I don't know, see what you think.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about our sponsor this week, BetterHelp.
Guys, if you feel that you need therapy or you've had therapy with a live person, you should be aware that online therapy is actually a valid option. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than you might think.
It's true. And as you guys probably know, not only have I been in therapy for quite a long time, I also am a psychotherapist. I'm actually training to be a clinical psychologist, and I can attest 100% that psychotherapy is beneficial. It can help you. And, you know, you don't have to be shy. You can try it out. If it's not right for you, the great thing about BetterHelp is that they make it easy to switch therapists so that you can find the right fit.
And remember, the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/SGU. That's BETTERHELP.com/SGU.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. Bob, tell us about restarting the LHC.
Yep, just hit the on switch and they're good. That was it.
And they're good.
Yeah. Here's your problem.
So, yeah, you had to switch off.
The Large Hadron Collider, LHC, yeah, has emerged from its four-year moribund state and is ready for run number three.
Woo-hoo.
So, is new physics beyond the standard model finally in the damn cards this time?
Yes.
Bob.
Okay. Well, we all know and love the LHC, right? It's the largest particle physics experiment in the world and also the largest machine in the world. Basically rams protons together at near the speed of light, and multiple detectors examine the wreckage to learn what makes reality tick. That's pretty much the LHC in a nutshell.
A big crash test.
So, basically. Yeah, right. So during the first, during its first run in 2012, famously found the Higgs boson.
Higgs.
Which is basically a manifestation of the Higgs field, which gives mass to things, anything that has mass, thanks to Higgs. And that capped a 5-decade search for the little bugger. Unabashed success.
The goddamn particle.
Time. Yeah, right. So now, but not long after that, the LHC was powered down basically for a couple years for upgrades, refurbishment, and then run two started in 2015 with high hopes. But that didn't go as well, at least as I had hoped. It looked early on, it looked like they were doing great. They found evidence of a new particle. And you know, everyone was saying it was evidence for supersymmetry, which posits, among other things, counterpart particles. So, photons would have cousins called photinos, and quarks would have their goofy cousins called squarks. It would have been really cool, because supersymmetry would have answered questions and even pointed to dark matter candidates. But that potential new particle that I mentioned just 12 seconds ago in run two was just a statistical anomaly. And now I know why. Nice. I know why. I know what happened. Because the theory that called those particles squarks and photinos, I'm convinced the universe said, squarks, Really? Well, I'm just going to change reality around a little bit so that they don't exist because you had, well, whatever. Okay, those names were horrible, but it didn't pan out. It didn't pan out. And then Run 2 was put out of its misery in 2018. And since then, the LHC has been busy getting ready for Run 3, which started, well, let me check my watch. Oh, yes, back on April 22nd. So what have they been doing for all these years since 2018? What was done? What might we expect? So a lot of what they've been doing is upgrades. One of the big things, they improved its luminosity. Now, that term in this context means that it's essentially more particle collisions per square centimeter per second. That's it. More collisions means more chances for cool stuff to happen and new science to happen. And while I'm on this subject, the beam line of the LHC, the tube that the beam runs through, needs to be evacuated of air, right? Because you don't want these protons to be hitting anything. So it's got to be the best vacuum possible. And it really is. Pressures in that tube, in the beam line, are as low as 1/10 trillionth of an atmosphere. Scientists call it the emptiest place in the solar system, which is 6 great words, the emptiest place in the solar system. I love it. A proton can travel for hundreds of hours and basically has zero chance of hitting an air molecule. Fantastic. All right. So they improved the luminosity. What else did they do? The detectors had to be beefed up too, because these detectors had to deal with all these new collisions that were happening. So better detectors. And then they needed, of course, you needed better data analysis techniques, right? Because you have to go through all that extra data that's being created by the beefier detectors made to handle all that extra luminosity. So all of that happened, but also magnets were upgraded. These superconducting magnets can allow for 13.6 tera electron volts, instead of just the paltry 13 TeV that they had in Run 2. So a lot more powerful. This one was new, a new detector, a small one called Phaser, F-A-S-E-R. This detects really low mass particles leaking from the LHC. And the hope here is that these particles that they might detect will be related to the dark sector, which is not as creepy as it sounds, since it just means dark matter. It's talking about like dark matter. So now dark matter is not part of the standard model of particle physics. And if this new detector called Phaser actually detected it, I mean, oh my God, that discovery would have Nobel Prizes pouring from it like sauce from Jay's meatballs. So that would be one of the big, big unforgettable events of Run 3 if they actually did, obviously, if they detected dark matter. Oh my God. Okay. But of course, there's a boring stuff that they've been doing for the past few years, like just refurbishing, right? The entropy happens. You know, you've got technical infrastructure that needs to be kind of looked at and fixed and repaired, cooling, ventilation, electrical distribution, elevators, cranes, fire detect, all that stuff. That's also been done. Okay. So now the hope for Run 3 that started last week. So one of the hopes is there's some things that truly mysterious at this point, and they're like, okay, we got to look into this during Run 3. One of these was the result of a recent analysis that showed that W bosons, which mediate the weak force, they were shown to have much higher masses than predicted by the standard model. That's really exciting. So a lot of the researchers that worked with this think that this is a definitive pointer to potentially new physics, like, for example, a brand new particle, or even better, a new force that could potentially be revealed by the LHC's Run 3, based on the fact that the standard model got this prediction off by, you know, a fairly wide margin. So this is an opportunity for new physics. That makes it exciting. You know, the standard model said the W bosons for the weak force are within this range of mass. You know, they analyze these results from another collider from like 10 years ago. And they're like, oh man, these masses are not in line with the standard model. Why is the standard model predicting, you know, is there a new force or particle that's making the mass different? That's really exciting. But you know, been down this road before, you know, I'm trying not to get my hopes up, but this one just could genuinely produce something. But we'll see. Let's see. The other thing that I really liked about the hopes for Run 3 for the LHC was thinking outside the box, which is I think they're really doing that here in this one area specifically. And that has to do with the common assumption that massive particles are very short-lived. And that's generally, essentially almost always, or maybe even always, it's been true in the past. If you've got a lot of mass, and you're an obscure particle, like say the Higgs boson, that lasted for a billionth of a trillionth of a second. It's got a high mass. It barely lasts for a flicker of a second, a billionth of a trillionth of a second. That's otherwise known as, say it with me, a sextillionth of a second, right, guys? That's
a sextillionth of a second.
One of my favorite numbers. So, but what if particles lasted far longer than a sextillionth of a second? They're calling these LLPs. For long-lived particles, decent initialism, I guess, LLPs. So what they're going to do is, because the thing is, if you live longer, if this particle is created out of the wreckage of crashing protons and it lives longer than you think, then it's going to be outside of the detector's range. The detector's not going to be focusing on this area because it didn't think that anything would ever live that long to get that far. So they revised their analysis techniques during run three that are specifically going to be looking for these LLPs. So
how did they define, like, what's the cutoff? Like 1,000th or 1,000,000th of a second?
Yep. I mean, I think that
it's
that
still
might,
tiny, right?
That, yeah, that's still tiny, but that might be too long lived, you know, compared to a sextillionth. Million is
like a quadrillion.
Yeah.
Whoa.
So I don't know what the cutoff is, but
probably a bajillionth.
Yeah, bajillionth. You got it. So everyone join me in wishing the LHC the best of luck in making run three the best one yet. Come on, we need some new physics. We need the standard model to collapse into a puddle of jelly because it just didn't make these predictions that they are now, you know, revealing in run three. Maybe, who knows? It would be great. I just hate to think that they would go a few years and not really have some really amazing stuff discovered. That would be very disappointing, but you never know what's going to happen. Fingers crossed.
That's why it's called research, Bob, right? Because we don't know what's going to happen.
I know. But, you know, after years and years, I want new physics. I'm so tired of the standard model. I want some new shit.
I'm done with the standard model.
Guys, the standard model says nothing about gravity, about dark energy, about dark matter. We know that stuff is real, and the standard model doesn't predict it.
It's so, just incomplete. We need to complete
it. Right, it's incomplete, and we want to get some theories about the stuff that we just don't know what to how do we describe the 94% of the universe, dark matter, dark energy. It's the biggest chunk of the universe, and standard model says, sorry, scoozy, don't know anything about this. Yeah. We need some theories. New physics, please.
The standard model needs its Jerry Maguire. You complete me. All right.
Somebody has to say it. All right, thank you.
All right, here we go. What do you guys know about emotional freedom technique? Kara, have you learned this in your psychological
studies? No, and here's the thing that's really annoying. They call it EFT. There's already something in psychology called EFT. It's emotion-focused therapy.
Oh,
and it's
they
like,
stole the initialism.
Yeah, and it's like somewhat legitimate.
Good use of that word, Steve, yes.
Yeah.
And so it's
that
frustrating when you
was
see...
taken.
Yeah, you see pseudoscience that uses the same initialism as a legitimate approach in therapy. It's confusing to the consumer.
Yeah,
totally.
They have an NFT for EFT now.
Now, it's also called energy psychology.
Oh, boy.
Red flags are popping off there.
Yeah, big time.
More popularly known as tapping therapy.
Gosh, it's getting worse.
Basically what happens. So this is how it works. I'm just going to read you a definition from a EFT promoting website. It says EFT works by tapping on acupressure meridians to release blockages. When these blockages are released, the problem feeling can be released and moved through the body. The process starts with the beginning statement of what the problem feeling is and includes a complete acceptance and acknowledgement of the problem. So if you are afraid of spiders, you would say something about spiders don't bother me while I tap on your face and hand, and then the emotional negativity associated with spiders magically goes away. It gets flushed through your body because it was trapped in the energy in those meridians. And by tapping these magical acupressure points, it releases it. And then you are free. You have emotional freedom. That's why it's the emotional freedom technique, right? Pure pseudoscience.
That's pathetic.
Whoa.
On its face.
Bad.
I mean, it's just like not even trying.
Yeah.
But it's incredibly popular, guys. This is a popular... Yeah, it is.
It's not mainstream.
Incredible.
Like, psychologists don't practice this.
Yes, they do.
Licensed psychologist.
Yes. It's like EMDR, just about 10 to 20 years behind.
Yeah, I was going to say it's not, because EMDR is problematic because there's some conversation about it being evidence-based.
There is a conversation about this being evidence-based as well.
What?
The problem is that the evidence is crap. Here's the problem.
Yeah.
So first of all, anything that involves acupoints is BS because acupuncture points do not exist. That we could say that as a positive statement. It's not just that we don't know if they exist, we don't know how they exist. They don't exist.
Yeah.
As much as we could say anything negative in science, right? It's been researched to death. And there's multiple independent lines of evidence that say that they just are not a thing. There is no anatomical, physiological, neurological, biochemical, or biological basis for acupuncture points existing. And if you
so
look,
it's a belief system.
If you look at the literature, and I have, and acupuncturists have, there's actually been a review by acupuncture saying, hey, let's look at the literature just to decide where, like, where exactly are the specific acupuncture points? Let's see what the literature says about that. And they concluded they're kind of everywhere. Like, they're if you include the error bars around where the quote unquote point is, it's just this huge portion of the body with massive overlap. They're basically everywhere. They essentially don't know where they are. Further,
right, what's the difference between them being everywhere and nowhere?
Yeah, further, if you look at like where's the acupuncture points that would be important for whatever, for treating migraine or for treating hypertension or whatever, how do they decide which acupuncture points are important for that particular indication? They just make it up. They get two or three acupunctures together and they decide where they are. And if you compare different studies, different acupuncturists pick different points for the same outcome.
Sounds like astrology.
It is astrology. It's actually literally astrology because when acupuncture was, you know, in its deep origins, it was there were 365 acupuncture points, one for each day of the year.
Coincidence.
It was literally astrological projections onto the body. It was the same pseudoscience, essentially.
Yeah.
Now there are thousands of acupuncture points. There's also different traditions, you know, whether it's Korean versus Chinese or whatever. There's auricular acupuncture. So we were talking about this before. If you rerun history, science would be the same, right? You would still have the same physics and the same biology or whatever. It's not culturally or historically dependent
because
it's reflecting reality. If you reran history, however, would pseudoscience be the same, right? Would we have the same pseudosciences? Would we have the same religions? Would we have the same belief systems? No, they would all be different because they're completely culturally contingent. They are not based in reality. And the same thing with acupuncture, it would not be the same. Like we would, there's, right? It's not like it's been independently rediscovered multiple times because it really exists. It's just completely a cultural construct and that's it. And it's, that has no basis in reality. So right there, we could pretty much write off EFT because it's based on something that doesn't exist. So the plausibility or prior probability is essentially zero. So what's happening? Why is there a debate about whether or not this is evidence-based?
It sounds like this is a purple hat, you know, therapy. When you mentioned EMDR, that's what's going on. Like,
totally.
There is a specific ingredient that's being tapped into that's not unique to this therapy. It's basically people are doing legitimate therapy while they're tapping on their bodies and then they're seeing a positive benefit.
Exactly.
And they're saying it's because of the tapping, not because they're doing therapy.
Yeah, it's like, here, we're going to do a little bit of cognitive behavioral therapy, a little bit of exposure therapy, and we're going to be tapping you while you're doing it. So, and is the tapping is that just a placebo effect or is it something real? And unfortunately, the state of the literature is pretty bad. The studies are not really rigorous. They haven't really figured out how to blind them properly. Most of them are small. Many of them are single blinded, where they don't really assess the blinding. The best studies I could find, whenever there's a study that has like a group that's a good control, it's negative. Like the comparison between EFT and that good control is not different. It's only when there is some methodological problem and you know, essentially allowing for poor blinding. So there are things in psychological research is hard to control for placebo effects because the outcome
is not a drug.
The outcomes are subjective. There's something that, you know, Carrie, you know what this is, demand characteristics, which
You want to please the doctor.
Subtle cues that tell the patient how they're supposed to respond, which is why if the treater is not blinded, again, it's worthless.
But it's also sometimes the therapy itself, there's no suitable placebo for the therapy because the therapy itself unblinds itself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yes. That's problematic because it's not a drug. You can't have a sugar pill. So sometimes you're doing a therapy. It's hard to blind that.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, but so you have to come up with a good sham, right? Where you're
right.
doing,
which is not always easy to do.
It's true, and it's also if the treater knows it's the sham, then that kills it because they're not going to have the enthusiasm. They're not going to, again, all those demand characteristics are not going to be there.
That's why randomized control trials are usually double blind, yeah, not they have just to be, single blind.
But not only double blind, they have to be. You have to have an active placebo. You have to evaluate the blinding and on both sides. And if there's a failure of blinding, the study with such a subjective outcome, especially since there's such thin margins where you already are expecting a huge effect from the treatment itself, you know, the behavioral, like the legitimate treatment component of this. There's also non-specific effects. Just we know that whenever you introduce a novel element into a therapy scenario, that has a huge placebo effect. So you're doing that as well.
And we also know that even not a placebo effect, but one of the non-specific effects, I guess that is technically also a placebo effect, is just being around a provider.
Exactly.
If you're in mental distress and somebody is talking to you.
And there's physical contact, which is another
placebo. Yeah, that in and of itself is healing.
Yeah. So, but there's no reason to think that the tapping is actually doing anything. It's just like EMDR. There's no evidence that the moving of the eyes, and it has to be like, oh, it's integrating the right and left hemisphere. They make these ridiculous, like neuroscientific psychobabble explanations for what's happening. And it's like poetry. It's not science.
Yeah. And that's why Gerald Rosen calls it a quote, purple hat therapy. Cause he has this whole scenario where he's like, let's say you're afraid to drive on a bridge and you work with a therapist and they teach you grounding exercises, breathing exercises, evidence-based approaches to help you get through this exposure therapy to drive on the bridge. And then they put a purple hat on you and they go, this purple hat is going to protect you from your stress. And then you drive over the bridge and you say, oh, it's the purple hat. That's why I was protected. No, it's all the freaking therapy you just had and all of the techniques you learned about how to not be as stressed as you drive across the bridge. That's EMDR. It's the purple hat.
Yeah.
And it's basically, it sounds like that's the tapping.
Totally.
But sadly, EMDR, I mean, it's, I don't think it's better because you're right. They base it on like neurobabble and just made up stuff, but at least they're not basing it on like chakras.
Yeah. It's hard to know what's worse. I agree. It's like there's two different flavors of annoying, but this is like explicitly endorsing energy medicine and acupressure points and all that stuff. It's just complete nonsense.
And for that reason, I do want to say, just to kind of like defend my field, of course, there are probably psychologists who do this, but the APA is not like, yeah, do this. They didn't list this as anything evidence-based. They don't promote this or say you should be using this therapeutic approach.
Yeah.
Just so you know.
Give it 10 or 20 years.
Oh, no, they're pretty good. They're like APA tries to be really, really, they're
what,
very
what do they say about
EMDR?
Forward.
That one's questionable.
Yeah,
for them,
see, that's
I think.
What I think this is heading in that direction. That's what I'm saying.
That's so scary.
But we'll see. The problem is they're not getting to the right threshold of clinical research, you know, where you have, remember we talked about, you have to pre-register your trials so that you can't have a file drawer effect. You need adequate effect size. They need to be powerful enough. You need a large study. It needs to be properly blinded. You need to assess the blinding, and it needs to be, you need to have a replicatable protocol. If you don't have that, you don't have a real phenomenon. You cannot demonstrate the phenomenon is real. And when the basis of it is magic, you need to be especially skeptical. And they're not, or a lot of practitioners are not. A lot of the people who are promoting it and saying, "Oh, it's evidence based," etc. It's not really evidence based. It's not. It's just, you are accepting a too low level of evidence. So it's very, very problematic. Okay, Evan, you're going to tell us about another paranormal pseudoscientific thing. This one in anthropology. Tell us about that.
Yeah, paranthropology. So like para anthropology,
like
kind of
shit?
Put together. Yes. All right. I read about this one at the Harvard Gazette in their science and technology section.
No.
What?
Yes.
What?
Hey, these are the facts. Colleen Walsh was the staff writer who handled this one. Anthropologist, here's the headline. Anthropologist describes supernatural adventures. Studying the paranormal can contribute to the field of anthropology, says Jack Hunter in a recent Harvard talk. Oh, yes, and he did give a talk online for about an hour. This was back in late March, and it got reported on. And fortunately, for the purposes of the news item, the talk's available that you can watch it on YouTube, and that's what I did. I watched it. It makes – well, let me jump to the news article first, and I'll go directly to the video and tell you what it says. But the news article makes some observations, a couple basic things. So again, the subject of the article is Dr. Jack Hunter. Here are some of his bona fides. I grabbed them directly from his website. He's an anthropologist exploring the borderlands of consciousness, religion, ecology, and the paranormal. He holds various teaching positions at the University of Wales Trinity St. David and at Newton College. His PhD at the University of Bristol took the form of an ethnographic study of contemporary trance and physical mediumship.
Wait, what? What does that even mean?
PhD in mediumship.
Mediumship?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Like, physical mediumship.
But like, okay. Very professional.
But wait. So like, just like theologians are scholars of the literature and the cultural norms around religion, please tell me this guy is just an anthropologist who studies how supernatural experiences shape culture and how stories around the supernatural.
Wouldn't that be nice if that's the world we lived in?
Oh, Kara, we were all thinking, I think, exactly that. Right, which would have some bearing.
Oh, that would be perfectly legitimate to study as an anthropologist.
Absolutely, to better understand past civilizations by those cultural influences and their belief systems.
Yeah, and how we got to who we are right now.
Absolutely. But, yeah. So he's a research fellow at a couple different places, among them the Parapsychology Foundation, which we've heard of before, I believe. And, oh, here's the more interesting one. He's a member of the Fairy Investigation Society.
Mm-hmm. What?
Fairy,
F-A-I-R-Y. Oh, the Fairy Investigation Society.
I was thinking,
wait, so he investigates fairy? Like, what the
Yes,
hell?
He does.
How?
He investigates fairies.
How?
And the Fairy Investigation Society, they missed an opportunity here. They should have called themselves the Fairy Investigation Guild, or FIG, and that way you could give a fig about it.
Nice. The fig.
But I digress.
So essentially, this guy, and this may be, there may be some racist history to this term, but he, as an anthropologist, he has quote unquote gone native, meaning that he's not studying about something from the outside. He now believes in it and is part of it from the inside.
Right. So that's the difference between an etic and an emic perspective, which interestingly, we usually want a more emic perspective. Yeah. We want to know like the inside view, but we want to ask people who are inside of it for that view.
Instead, he inserts himself into it and goes into these experiences himself and gives his own relays his own information about the experiences that he had.
From a believer perspective, himself. Again, not from an object, he lost his objectivity. It's like the other Harvard professor, the psychologist, psychiatrist,
John Mack,
who believed the delusions of his own patients. No, as a psychiatrist, you're not supposed to believe your own patients' delusions.
Right. And that's, I think, also UFO the difference. It's sort of like a misappropriation of the emic and etic perspective, because those usually just refer to the cultural viewpoints of the individuals. It's like, you don't want to have this colonialist, like, I, white man from the West, am going to tell you about these peoples. Like, you want to really understand the people from their perspective, but that's not really, that doesn't translate to, I'm going to believe in pseudoscience.
Yeah, right.
Yikes.
I'll give you, I watched the whole hour presentation, and I'll give you a couple pullouts that I found that I thought were interesting. Here's three of them, all right? And then we can talk about each one. Here's a quote. The paranormal is perfectly natural. It makes sense when you look at the data where people claim to have these experiences all over the world, all through time, and they seem to be normal and natural in that respect.
Meaning what, though? So,
well,
sure.
So what?
Having those experiences is normal because everyone has this, our brains are flawed, right? Because our brains are glitchy, right, as I like to say. And so it's natural for humans with glitchy brains to have experiences that are unusual, but they are internal. It's not natural in that it's not an external experience, but he is saying that it is, of course, that this is like the
right.
universe
ignoring,
is paranormal.
Right. He's right. ignoring the fact that the interpretations are culture bound.
Yes, right.
Steve, do you know what it reminded me of? It's an expression that I like to use, which I stole from you and you stole it from Joan Nichol. There are no haunted places. There are only haunted people. Doesn't that kind of sum it
yeah.
up?
Yeah.
Like the constant here is the human brain throughout time, all over the world. I mean, you have these cultural differences, right, and descriptions of what's going on. That differs. But the constant here is the people and the yeah. human brain, no doubt
the
about
same
it.
Same is true of sleep and dreaming. That doesn't mean your dreams are real.
How about this one? Here's another quote. He described his first extraordinary experience, which was under the effect of magic mushrooms. He saw fairies, small entities, and they seemed to appear as 2D beings in the wood grain pattern on a chest of drawers. They looked at me. There seemed to be some sort of intelligence or agency behind this aspect of the experience.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he hallucinated.
Yeah, he was literally, yes. admittedly hallucinating.
He just said he took right. a hallucinogenic substance.
That's a way to do science, sure.
But it kind of went beyond it. It would be one thing if he said, because this experience happened before he got into his academic pursuits. It was from what he described in his teen years or his late teen years. So I'd like to take a little bit of charity with that. So it wasn't during his academic career. But he never said or he never suggested that something like, oh, I came later to realize from my studies I was seeing patterns in random noise. Or this was my first experience with intersubjective entry into archaeology. And now I have a better understanding of the cultural practices of those societies. No, he all but outright said that it happened. And he never came off of that, or he never suggested that it was what he experienced at the time. But now, since then, he's moved on from that. No, he embraces it. It sounds like he says it cannot be accounted for by the standard models of science and psychology.
But it can.
Which is a recurring theme. I know.
And also, he's not a scientist or a psychologist. So maybe he should be doing some consultation.
Yeah, well, this is the problem, and that's a constant theme throughout the hour-long talk, is that where's the neurology? Where's the psychology, right? Where are the hard – where's the physics?
Missing.
Where's the hard sciences? Mm-hmm. It's all missing. It's all absent. Here's one more. I'll give you guys one more, and then we'll move on. The nature of these – this is his quote. The nature of these kinds of experiences, supernatural or paranormal experiences, from the mainstream perspective, they say these experiences must be delusional or explained away in terms of psychopathology or whatever. But there is a way we can look at these experiences without breaking them down, treating them seriously on their own terms. And then what happens if you treat these experiences seriously? It leads you off into different areas, and that includes anthropology. So I think what he's talking about here is removing the boundaries, or as he actually puts it, he uses the word the brackets that separate the world of physics and standard models and breaks it away from the human experiences of spirituality, faith, and other subjective experiences. In fact, he says at a couple different times, you specifically have to take down those barriers if you're going to be a para-archaeologist.
Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. You have to believe the crap you're spewing.
But guess what? When you do that, it ain't science.
No, it's definitely not an attempt at objectivity. I mean, we know we can never be fully objective, but at least we try.
Yeah, it's
He's
an
not
aspiration.
Trying. Yeah.
Yeah.
Almost a more problematic statement. So in the interview, you know, he was asked, well, what do you think about the mediums where they've been shown to be fake? And he said, that doesn't mean that everything else is fake.
Oh, yeah. Logical fallacy. Yeah. Hello. Like,
yeah. It doesn't mean that any of them are real either. They all could be fake. So, you know, it does put the onus on you to show one that's objectively not fake. And nobody can do that forever. I wonder why that is. Then he says, well, then you're taking out of the real world experience into the lab. So it's the unfalsifiable framework, right? So that's...
It's sad, too, because it's like there is a world in which... I mean, look at Susan Blackmore. Like, there's a world in which you are credulous of this and then you realize, right? Or maybe you were never credulous to begin with, where you can still study this in a deep phenomenological way, like in a very constructivist way, and try to understand it from the perspective of the experiencers and still get a richness of your literature and your research without also condoning or believing in or being credulous about the practice.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
And he blows right past that. And that's what takes it from science into pseudoscience.
All right. Thanks, Evan.
Yeah, yep.
Jay, it's Who's That Noisy Time.
Last week, I played this noisy. All right, what is this?
It's Darth Vader on an exercise bike.
So many people wrote in Darth Vader.
Yeah, you have to.
Well, sure, because it has a bellows, right? It sounds like a bellows of some sort.
Oh, bellows would make sense. That would give it that breathing vibe.
Yeah.
Well, Howard accordingly, he said, my six-year-old son watched the guest this week, and he said, it's a tiger, no, a lion, no, wait, a liger. That is out of breath. How very 6 years old of his son is so
That's
adorable.
Awesome.
Yes, it is, but it is not any of those things. But it sounds like that. Hmm. Next person wrote in, named Camilla, and this person said, please tell me that's a rotary phone. Sounds like they're dialing 0992648211 or something like that.
No, it doesn't.
It's remarkable what people hear in their heads.
Camilla, thank you for listening, and tell Charles we all say hello, by the way.
Evil Eye, who has written in many times.
Since the get-go, he's year one listener.
Totally.
Evil Eye.
You don't get more classic than this listener. He said, no clue, but taking a shot, it sounds like someone either filling or regulating a hot air balloon.
Okay.
I can see that.
Yeah. I like that.
That bellowsy vibe to it, yeah.
Another listener, Ben, wrote in, said, hey guys, Ben here from Kyoto. It sounds like someone cutting a big chunk of wood with a handsaw, and it feels very similar to a growling beast.
Mm-hmm.
That actually, you know, that part of what he said is not 100% off, and you shall learn as we progress here. Another listener named A.E. Coleman wrote in and said, hi, Jay, longtime listener here. Is the noisy from episode 876 a big cat of some kind, a lion, a tiger, a puma, etc., breathing through its nose into a paper towel tube?
That's very specific.
My house cats and I eagerly await the answer. That is not correct, but hold on. Another person here wrote, hi, Jay, interesting one this week. Is it someone using a handsaw on polystyrene? Alternatively, it's Bob on the night before Halloween. Cheers, Phil.
We're always so excited.
So there's lots of thematically, there is a lot of people here saying things about big cats, right? Or, you know, growling and things like that. Now, there is no winner this week because this one was very hard, but I found this one to be fascinating. Let me explain to you what it is. So do you guys hear the growl of an animal in there at all?
I hear chuffing.
Maybe.
I hear breathing of an animal. I don't hear growling.
Listen to this. Does that sound like a big cat?
No.
It sounds like a big animal chuffing or breathing.
Okay. All right, so what this is this is a method that old-time hunters used to use to call jaguars. All right, so this is a constructed noise.
It's a jaguar call.
So this is from Kelly, who sent the original noisy in, that they would float down a river making the noise, waiting for a response, and then once they see a jaguar, they would release their hounds and they would hunt them. So what this actually is, you know, like those big – like a big plastic tub that like you can get at Home Depot or something, mm-hmm. You know, just like a, you know, like a big, these tubs, like you could buy these and like taping compound comes in them or whatever. But like those deep tubs, they typically have pictures on them of like, don't let your kid fall in here because they could suffocate, right? You know, the tub I'm talking
about.
Yeah.
You drill a hole in the middle bottom of the tub. And then what they would do is they would take leather lace and they would pull it through the hole. Right, so it's like a shoestring, say, of leather. They'd pull it through the hole and drag it on the perimeter of the little hole that they drilled in the bottom.
Wow, it really sounds like breathing.
Yeah, and then it vibrates the entire bucket, and it also, because it's inside the bucket, that bucket makes a very throaty kind of sound. So visualize that as you hear this sound. Now, they're pulling it back and forth, and they're using different tensions on it to make inflections, you know, the inflection sound different. But listen again. see it now?
Mm-hmm.
You can kind of visualize it.
Oh, yeah.
I thought that was really cool because, you know, it's a hunting call that they use to fool jaguars into thinking that other jaguars were nearby and the jaguars would come and check it out. But it just so happens to have a very big cat kind of, you know, what did you call that, Kara? What kind of sound is that?
A chuff.
Is that pleasant?
It's like what the sound that they make when they're safe. It's like a pleasant sound when they breathe.
Yeah, and I hear that. I hear that. I also hear something more aggressive at the same time.
It doesn't sound that aggressive to me. Can I tell you like a little tidbit? Something that's evidence-based that does absolutely attract jaguars. What? And scientists use it. They mark their camera trails with it or their trail cameras with it. Calvin Klein's obsession for men.
I don't disbelieve that because, you know, people who create perfume use real world scents to
They use civet oil, or now it's synthetic, but it used to be made with civet oil, and it turns out that is like really attractive to jaguars. So don't go on a hike through the Amazon wearing Calvin Klein's obsession for men.
Unless you have one of these buckets with a hole in it with a leather string. Yeah, be careful.
Real world application of skepticism.
So that was a cool one. I have a new sound for you guys this week, and good luck guessing.
Whoa.
That sound was sent in by a listener named Lewis Goldberg. Thank you, Lewis. If you think you know what you heard this week, or you heard something cool, because you're a cool person and you're in cool places and you do cool things, send me a cool noisy at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Bob, less attitude.
Thanks, Jay. I'm just going to do some corrections for the email segment this week about the Bermuda discussion from a couple of weeks ago.
Oh.
Got a couple of emails, one from a biologist from Sweden, Soren. No, you didn't. This is all about the chatting that we had around the discussion. It wasn't about any of the items. Anyway, so I'm not going to read the email, but there was a few things correcting some specific things that I said during it. So one was, we were talking about Australia. Remember, so with the Bermuda science fiction, one of the things was which animals are native to the island. Mm-hmm. And I said there were no native bats. There were no native mammals. That was the fiction because bats made it to the island because bats can fly. Yeah. And I said that's similar to Australia. When we were in Australia, we heard that bats were the only placentals that are native to Australia. So he was pointing out that that's in fact not true, that because there are rodents that are also considered native to Australia. So it's bats and rodents, not just bats.
Oh, there are placental rodents?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Because I know there's also non-placental rodents, right?
They're not rodents, but they are.
Oh, right. They wouldn't be
analogous to rodents.
Yeah, they look like
they're marsupial. Yeah, it's like the Tasmanian tiger it's similar to like a big cat. There are marsupial mice, basically, but they're not rodents, right? But that sent me down a rabbit hole of that whole issue of what is considered native to Australia.
Yeah, and that's why I was asking about the word endemic too. Like, how do we define?
Well, we'll get to that.
Okay.
So that's the second thing he corrected. What is native, right? What is considered native? So essentially, it actually depends on whether or not it's an animal or a plant or a person. Mm-hmm. But there's the difference between native, indigenous, and endemic.
Yeah.
Right. So native means that the species is it's part of the natural ecosystem of that area. But here's a question though. How long ago would an animal species or would a species have to have been introduced to an area before we consider it to be native?
I know that there's probably no hard, fast rule about that, is there?
There's no hard and fast rule about
it. So
bats were introduced into Australia 15 million years ago.
Yeah, that's probably
rodents,
indigenous.
Yeah, so they're now considered native. Mm-hmm. Rodents 5 to 10 million years ago.
Probably still indigenous.
No problem. Yeah, they're considered native. Mm-hmm. What about, this is controversial, what about dingoes?
Where did they come from?
Four to 5,000 years ago.
Ooh.
They were introduced by humans. Mm-hmm. as domesticated dogs 4,000 to 5,000 years ago.
Oh, they were already domesticated.
But now they are a wild species and that are self-sustaining within the ecosystem of Australia. And it's currently controversial. Now, legally, they are not native. And that's partly because Australia then has more freedom to control their population because they're technically an introduced species. So from a legal perspective, there may be a motivation to say that they're not native. But scientists are like, all right, that aside, where do we draw the line? I actually found a paper by a scientist who is saying, I think we should follow these three criteria. You know, one is that they evolved, right? Like the species actually has demonstrably physically evolved since being in the region where they are.
Okay.
Two is that they exist independent of humans, right? They don't need to be fed or in any way interact with humans in order to be self-sustaining. And that they are integrated into the ecosystem and like they would actually damage the ecosystem if they were removed.
That's where all the controversy is, because you don't know yes. that unless you do it.
But she said, if you can infer that though, you can say, yeah, they're integrated into the ecosystem in such a way that it would be disruptive if they were just removed. So
right, but we've learned that even happens when we remove invasive species.
Yeah, that's true, but you have to have all three of these at the same time, right? You have to be self-sustaining, independent of human activity. You have to be integrated into the ecosystem, and you have to have evolved in this location. Dingoes were definitely, you know, an invasive species when they were first introduced. They drove the Tasmanian devil in Australia to extinction, right? That's why they only exist in Tasmania now. But now 4,000 years later, are they now a native species? And again, it's controversial. There's no answer to that. I'm just saying that there are a range of opinions. And some people say, you can come up with criteria to say that, yeah, they should be considered a native species to Australia now. They've been there long enough. Obviously, rodents and bats, millions of years, fine. That's like way past the line. But there's no objective demarcation line. All right, now endemic. So you asked me what does endemic mean, and I gave you the medical definition of endemic, which is that it's a self-sustaining population in an area. Because like we would say measles is endemic in the United States, so that would mean that it's self-sustaining. It doesn't have to be introduced from the outside.
Right. But in an ecology sense, it's just a smaller range, right?
No. What it means is that, well, sort of, but it means you're endemic to a region. It means you're only in that region.
Yeah, yeah.
So something that's endemic to Bermuda exists only in Bermuda. If it exists anywhere else, then it's native to Bermuda, mm-hmm. but not endemic. So endemic is native, but also restricted only to that location that you're talking about.
Right. The Galapagos, whatever finch is endemic to the Galapagos. Like you can't find it anywhere else. Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. Right. So that was the thing that I got wrong. I didn't know that that was a distinction mm-hmm. between the medical and the biological use of the word endemic. It's a little confusing, which is why there's another term to refer to that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the word, there's a more technical term for it called precinctive. That was created by a biologist because he didn't like the fact that the same word had two different meanings and two different specialties,
right?
In biology and medicine. So he said, we need to come up with a new term that's not endemic so people don't get confused. But I've never heard that term before. And I don't think it gets used that often, but it does exist. So if you want to say endemic and not be confusing, you could say precinctive, but nobody will know what you're talking about. All right. So interesting. Things are always more complicated than you think. And I think I did talk about the difference between introduced and invasive. An introduced species becomes invasive when it extends beyond the location where it was introduced, right? So it starts to spread into the environment. Then it becomes invasive. It's invading other places.
Oh, it's not also just defined by its ability to kind of like overwhelm a balanced ecosystem?
Well, that is a typical feature of invasive species because they don't have natural predators. You know, they tend to have advantages mm-hmm. to survival because they are disruptive and others like native species don't have resistance to them.
Right.
You know, so yeah, they tend to be very disruptive. All right, well, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Although we have three news items this week, there is a theme to these news items.
Mm-hmm.
And the theme is future technology.
Oh,
see how I circled back to our book? These are all
Evan
things.
Evan and I are at a distinct disadvantage here.
Yep.
All things that you might read about in our book, or they involve those things. Okay, here we go. It's not going to help them care. Don't worry about it. Item number one. Using a quantum 2D material, scientists have produced the highest ambient pressure superconductor at 250K, minus 23 degrees Celsius. Item number two, NASA scientists have developed a metal alloy that has twice the tensile strength, three times the ductility, and at least 1,000 times the durability at high temperature and stress as existing superalloys. And item number three, using machine learning and genetic modification, scientists have created a bacteria-producing enzyme that can rapidly break down PET plastic, which makes up 12% of global solid waste, so that it can be reused and is practical for industrial-scale use. Kara, go first.
A quantum 2D material. That doesn't even sound like a thing. What is a 2D material? It's flat. But nothing's actually flat.
So I'll give you that
2D
one, one molecule thick material, even though it's not physically 2D, it's considered 2D. Like graphene is a 2D material because it's one atom.
Right, that makes that more
thick.
Believable now.
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't know what that means. It's a quantum material. Isn't everything subject to quantum? Like, this is confusing to me, but okay, scientists.
That's what they're calling it. You might make it a metamaterial.
Yeah, I feel like that's like marketing. They've produced the highest ambient pressure superconductor. So the idea here is that they figured out how to increase the ambient pressure. So not like
no,
a
I'm
vacuum.
Sorry. Let me.
Do you mean temperature?
Yeah, it's the highest temperature. It's the highest. I left that word out. It's the highest.
Oh, good. Okay.
Temperature ambient pressure superconductor.
Okay. So an ambient pressure superconductor is a type of superconductor, and they've managed to now increase the temperature at which it functions. Because I know that, superconductors have to be very, very, very cold. So 250
So the ambient
Kelvin.
Pressure basically means one atmosphere, right?
Okay. Yeah. Like they can do it here. They don't have to put it in the back or whatever. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. I have no idea if negative 23 degrees Celsius is like way off target and really this has to be close. I don't think it has to be close to absolute zero though, because I've seen superconductors at like science fairs before, like doing that thing where they look like a air hockey table. So like clearly if they can figure out how to make it cold just like out on a table, I don't know, negative 23 degrees, sure. that still seems pretty cold to me. NASA scientists have developed a metal alloy. This one has so many caveats. Okay, so it's a metal alloy, so it's multiple metals that have improved the tensile strength by two times, the ductility by three times, and the durability, this is the main one, by 1,000 times, but only at high temperatures.
No. I mean, not only at high temperature, even at high temperature. That's the whole point. This is for like rockets and jets, right?
Gotcha.
If you expose it to high temperature and stress, it doesn't get destroyed. You know, it lasts 1,000 times longer than existing metals.
Right. And then this last one is that both machine learning and GM produced an enzyme from bacteria that can break down PET. Okay, that doesn't seem that unreasonable. So it can be reused. And they've also figured out how to scale it. That's the big question. Because we've seen a lot of issues. Like we've seen a lot of different, even bacteria that they didn't have to produce in a lab. But I guess they wouldn't be scalable. That's where the machine learning comes in. So that one seems reasonable to me, too. They all seem reasonable. So I guess I'm going to say the quantum 2D material, maybe they were able to figure out, or the 1,000 times the durability at high temperature. Maybe it's 100 times. Yeah, I'll say NASA didn't figure out the metal alloy thing because we've been working on metal alloys for forever. And it seems weird that they would be like, oh, I never thought to combine these two metals. Look at all the great properties. Like, you would think that they would have already tried a lot of different combinations. So we'll say that one's a fiction, but who freaking knows?
Okay, Evan.
I guess the one that makes the most sense to me is the plastic one, the created a bacteria-produced enzyme. that can break down the plastic? Haven't they been working on that for a while? I could have sworn. Have we covered news items about that in the past? I seem to have some recollection of that. But this one is a the new feature would be what? Using machine learning and genetic modification. So sure, you take a concept you've been working on a while, you use the latest, greatest other pieces of technology to make it even better. And that would be great. So the so I think that one's science. The other ones, shooting in the dark here. Quantum 2D material and what, the highest ambient pressure. Nobody knows this. I mean, what? Unless you're in the field. How would you – 23 degrees Celsius? Negative 23 degrees Celsius? I mean, who knows that? Nobody knows that. So what? I mean, okay, sure. I wouldn't know if that was news if it came up and smacked me in the face like Will Smith. Too soon?
No, too late. Okay. It's like almost you missed the Will Smith wave there, Evan.
I was busy doing taxes, thank you. Actually being a productive member of society. Now, the one Kara says is talking about, the metal alloy, twice the tensile strength, three times the ductility, and 1,000 times the durability at high temperature. And
at least.
At least 1,000 times. Well, those are some pretty impressive numbers, especially that 1,000 times. So it's a coin flip. Kara, I'm gonna ride with you on this one. I'll say it's the metal alloy one, but it's a total guess.
Yeah, total guess.
All right, well, we'll see how my fellow authors did, see if they're
writing this one's all on you guys.
Help them out. So, Jay, go ahead.
No credibility pressure here. Go ahead.
You know, the one about the metal alloy, you know, to have 1,000 times durability at a high temperature, that's freaking remarkable. I mean, what's a high temperature, though?
The temperatures at like 2,000 degrees, like temperatures that you would experience in a jet, you know, cone or whatnot in aerospace.
What?
Relevant aerospace temperatures.
Well, this is definitely something that NASA would be continuously working on, is trying to come up with better materials. I mean, I just think 1,000 times the durability is so much more durable than what you would think they would be able to achieve with the same old metals. You know what I mean? Because, you know, Steve's not saying anything here about exotic metals or, you know, anything crazy. So that one's a maybe. The third one here, using machine learning and genetic modification, scientists have created a bacteria-produced enzyme that can break down the plastics. Yeah, I mean, there's really no reason to think that this one is that big of a deal. I've read tons of things about this type of stuff. You know, I would imagine that the problem here would be to scale up the creation of that bacteria, because it's always a scaling problem. So I'm going to just say that one's science, and I'll move off to the first one. Using a quantum 2D material, scientists have produced the highest ambient pressure superconductor. Yeah, it has to exist at minus 23 degrees Celsius. So between that one and the 1,000 times durability, I mean, you know, they're both on the edge there, because I could see, yeah, they made an advancement in a superconductor at one atmosphere. That one doesn't seem that crazy either. I think I'm going to say that it's the metal one, because 1,000 times durability seems too high for me.
All right, Bob.
Oh, my God. All three of you guys are just adorable.
yes, please tell me you know this.
Thanks, Bob.
So, all right, the PET plastic sounds feasible, and we need a win there. So I'm going to say that's science. All right, 2D material. This is extraordinary because you've got a high ambient pressure. You've got one atmosphere, and at the same time, minus 23 is nothing. That's damn near room temperature. That's amazing, okay?
Yeah.
So that's fantastic right there, because usually it's ambient temperature but still damn cold, or it's crazy pressure. You know, crazy pressure between two diamond anvils, but also a room temperature. So you never get both at the same time, which we have here. And Steve knows that I know this. So he knows that I'm going to say that's bullshit. And so for that reason, and of course, that act in and of itself is a roll of the die, because who knows how deep Steve went with his mind screwing that he's doing to me here. So what? I don't care. I don't think because that's huge. That's really big news. I did a look at the news you know, lately. I didn't see that. That would be really, wow. really amazing. So I'm going to just go with the metal and ductility.
No, really? Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so funny. You guys just stumble on that. And I try to reason it out because I happen to be familiar with some of these. And it's like, it's still a goddamn roll of the dice here.
Oh, I wanted
it doesn't
you to
matter
have a solo
how much
win.
You know. It's just all just total
it's
random
very nice
bullshit.
Of you, Kara.
I did because
didn't.
He like, this is like his world, you know?
Yeah, but normally I would say the 2D material is fiction. But Steve knows, he knows for certain that I
he's laying a trap for you,
find
Bob.
This, yeah, he could be a trap
for you.
It always bites me in the ass when I play science or fiction based on what I think, how I think Steve is effing with my head versus like,
I know.
Just what I think is the right answer.
That's problematic. That's problematic. But I mean, I was looking at the news 10 minutes ago, you know, it's like when we, you know,
wow.
So based on, you add those together. You know, not 10 minutes, I mean 10 minutes before this segment started. as soon as this segment starts, of course, I would never go anywhere near any news. But I looked at a few things. So this thing didn't pop up. So when you add those two together, all right. So I'll say the ductility one, the metal one, that's not a shoo-in either because it could have all of these characteristics, no problem. But, oh, by the way, at room temperature, it explodes, you know? Something crazy could be wrong. We're not looking at all the characteristics here. But so I'll say that one's fiction. And I'll go with the crew.
Weird.
And see what the hell happens.
All
yeah.
aboard.
I mean, yeah, Steve could have swept us this week.
So you're saying the NASA scientist material, that's the fiction. You're going to agree with everybody else.
Oh, yeah, I think there's something. I think the first one could be true, but there's some major flaw. Major flaw. I'm hoping.
We'll start with number three, since you guys were the least conflicted about that one. Using machine learning, genetic modification, scientists have created a bacteria-produced enzyme that can rapidly break down PET plastic, which makes up 12% of global solid waste, so it can be reused and is practical for industrial-scale use. You guys all think this one is science.
Yeah, that's the caveat that could get us.
Is
say it.
Science. This is
yes.
Science.
Cool.
That's
this
awesome.
Is great.
Yeah.
That's so, big. This, yeah. this sounds good.
Yeah. Just, I mean, and the new bit here is the practical for industrial scale use, because this is not the first bacteria that eats plastic.
No, this is like college student, like science fair. I've seen so many bacteria that can eat plastic.
Yeah.
We've been talking about this for years.
It's not eating plastic so much as breaking it down to its components. So that those components could be reassembled into new stuff. So the purpose of this is to have a closed loop of plastic production, right? So it could be infinitely reused because you just break it down into its components, reform it, and you could do it again.
Yeah, it makes it like aluminum cans.
Yeah.
But so, sorry, you may not know this, but I'm actually really excited and curious about this. So I could see a system in which people return their plastics to the manufacturer. There's some sort of like new recycling portion where they, you know, save those types of plastics to go back to the factories where they do this. But what about the plastic that's already in the environment? Is there a way that this would help that?
We'd have to get it to a factory. Yeah.
Okay.
So it's just trying to make a circular process for plastic. Right. And so the advantages here, and this is where like the machine learning came in, because they had to predict what the structure of the enzyme should be, and then they had to use genetic modification to make it. So that's the future technology bit.
And that's big too.
And that's huge. It's totally huge.
What a team up.
Years of research and weeks, all that stuff, all those promises, it's all happening, guys. We are living in the future. It's amazing the shit that's happening right now. Wait till I get to the other one. That's not
fiction. Uh-oh.
That's cool.
Curious. So it's fast. It's very fast. It could do this in a week. So it doesn't take months to break down the plastic.
Okay.
And it could operate at like 50 degrees Celsius, which is fine. It doesn't have to be superheated or anything. So it's practical for industrial scale use. So you could build a factory tomorrow doing this, right? There's no deal breakers here. That's really the new bit. So we'll see how it works out. But I mean, from everything that I'm reading, they were saying this is ready to go. Like this could be an industrial process. And you know, again, it still creates the problem of you have to recycle the plastic. But if you can create a stream for that plastic that is economically feasible, right, then that creates a huge incentive for it to happen.
Well, yeah, because then more manufacturers will use PET, like will move over from other plastic types.
It'll
and
be
also
cost effective to recycle it. Yeah.
And it's individuals already mostly incorrectly recycle plastic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. So if we can just, it's about modifying behavior away from a, it's a slight modification. It's not about teaching people to recycle, which is good.
Yeah. So they do say that they're trying to prepare for industrial and environmental application, Kara. So it's possible
they may try
to, I don't know, put this in the water and just have it eat all the plastic. I don't know if that would work.
At the very least, put it in a landfill.
Yeah, landfill is probably where it would get used.
Yeah.
All right, let's go in reverse order. Go down to number two. NASA scientists have developed a metal alloy that has twice the tensile strength, three times the ductility, and at least 1,000 times the durability at high temperature and stress as existing super alloys. You guys all think this one is the fiction, and this one is science.
No
awesome.
Way.
This is awesome. And cool. NASA hit
you
it out of the park.
Got me, you
I watched a half an hour video on this, and the guy is so mellow throughout the whole thing, and I'd be like, oh my God. All right. Right.
Oh, and I take having absolutely no responsibility for asking this.
No, I blame Bob.
You
How do
better.
You think they made this amazing alloy? This is part of the futurist technology thing, Bob and Jay. They 3D
machine learning and genetic modification.
They 3D printed it, Steve.
They 3D printed it. They did use AI to predict what would work.
Oh my God! Right there.
And again, it was like
there we go, kids.
Years of research in weeks. All right, so
6 months of research. Yeah, over the weekend.
The basic alloy that they use. So obviously, NASA and the aerospace industry has been working on, you know, metal alloys that can withstand high strain and temperatures for their jet engines and rockets and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So the current sort of best that we have are these super alloys, nickel-based super alloys. And what they were doing was adding another process to that, oxide dispersion strengthened nickel-based super alloy. So what they do here is they use an oxide, in this case, yttrium oxide, and they disperse it throughout the alloy. So it tends to collect at the edges of the grains. You know how metals have grain sizes, you know,
yeah,
that determine its physical properties. So these form at the grain brown boundaries and makes it stronger.
Grains.
Now, how do they do it? They take the basic alloy that they're using. In this case, they used nickel, cobalt, chromium, right? So that's their starting alloy, nickel, cobalt, chromium. And they coat it with yttrium oxide. They coat the particles. So now you have this powder of the metal alloy, which you then coat with the yttrium oxide. And then they use a laser 3D printing method, right? Where it basically melts it together to create whatever it is they're building out of it, right? In this case, they were building a combustion chamber out of this alloy with the yttrium oxide. And they, you know, they examined it all sorts of ways, looking at all the structure and everything. And then they did the stress testing. So they found that it had all of these capabilities, you know, that higher tensile strength and ductility. Normally those don't go together. Like if you increase one, you decrease the other.
But yeah.
This increased both at the same time, and the guy's like, which is a pretty interesting property. It's like, yeah, that's really interesting.
Oh my God, dude.
Like, it was such understatement. and then they did the big test, was they put it actually at like twice the temperature that the normal alloys can tolerate. So normally you need to have some kind of insulation, even with the current super alloys, in order for it to survive a combustion chamber on a jet, right? And you still would. So like jets will burn at like 3,000 degrees. Normal alloys can withstand maybe 1,000 degrees. This can withstand 2,000 degrees. So it's like, it's much hotter. And then they also do like they look at the formation of stress cracks at high temperature and strain. And they showed the curves of like when they happened. They had to actually alter the scale. Like they had to squeeze it all the way down. So you could see, and I said at least 1,000 times, because the experiments are still running. They're still going. That's when they stopped looking. They were at 1,000 times the duration of the other previous best super alloys. So these things, just
wow,
they were incredibly, incredibly durable. Which, that's of course, insane. for you know, a jet engine that's being used over and over again and going up and going down, you know, that's what we want, right? We don't want our ships to fall apart. So,
ideally.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a huge advance again, and it's the 3D printing of the metal 3D printing, you know, where they use a metal powder and then they use a laser to melt it.
That, when did this happen, Steve?
This is very recent, you know, just this year.
The video I looked at was
February for this year.
Is kind of a game changer here, right?
Yeah.
Because, like, helping to determine which combinations could potentially have a more positive outcome.
Out of, the quadrillions of types.
It's a lot less trial and error.
Yeah, they're using materials they've been working with for ages.
It's a lot less trial and error. Exactly. Now, it's not just this one metal, too, right? This is just one of the ones that they're working with. You can use the same technique, this ODS technique, with different, you know, super alloys to strengthen them. And here's the other thing. So, like, you look at, like, well, I didn't give you all the information because I had to cut it off somewhere, but the other information is also all good, Bob. So, for example, if you look at the strength to density, it's better. So, in other words, you get more strength at a lighter, total lighter construction, which, of course, for aerospace is huge.
That's fantastic.
But they could also, they could emphasize that. They could say, all right, now let's take a super light material and just try to make that strong enough to function maybe not in a combustion chamber, but somewhere else. And just so we could, you could optimize the lightness of the material that we're using versus optimizing the durability like we need in a combustion chamber.
Right, right.
So this is
super light. Like,
yeah.
Like so, predator metal.
So this is a technique that could spawn 100 super alloys, you know, this ODS strengthened.
Yeah, it's the ODS technique that's the game changer, not this this new material.
But now ODS is itself like 20, 30 years old. It's this new way of doing it with the 3D printing that's better, because the previous techniques were expensive and time-consuming and difficult.
Okay.
And they figured out a way of just coating the part, the powder particles, and doing it in 3D printing. That's the innovation. It became...
Oh, so it's not the metal that they're using to coat it.
No, so it's the metal is the powder that they're making the thing out of, and they're coating the metal with the yttrium oxide, which is the strengthening agent.
But it's not the yttrium oxide that's necessarily an innovation here. It's how they're doing
it. It's using the 3D printing to make it much faster, cheaper, easier, and better. You get a better distribution, better microstructure characteristics. Everything is good. So it's not only better, it's faster, cheaper, easier. So now it's like you could just start printing your planes, you know, and your rockets out of this stuff. You know, we know they're already using, like, SpaceX is using 3D printing for a lot of their components.
A lot of engine parts. It has to be part of any.
It translates right over. Yeah, it translates right over.
Yeah, they've been doing it for years and years and years. They used to call it additive manufacturing.
They still do.
Yeah.
Throughout this, they call it AM or additive manufacturing.
Yeah. That's not new.
All right, Steve.
All right, so number using one. A quantum 2D material, scientists have produced the highest temperature ambient pressure superconductor at 250K or minus 2.83 degrees Celsius. That is the fiction, but it's morphed from an equally cool news item.
Hold on.
They did use a quantum 2D material, so that part is real, a quantum 2D material to create a new superconductor. It's just the new advantage to the superconductor is different than just being at a higher temperature. It's still a super low temperature superconductor, but, and you may not immediately recognize the importance of this, it's a one-way superconductor, one-directional superconductor,
What do you mean?
I don't even know what that means.
The current only flows in one direction.
The current flows in only one direction. Why is that?
It usually flows in both with the superconductor? Oh,
yes.
Okay.
It always inflows in both with all previous superconductors. This is the first superconductor in which it flows in only one direction. And
what the hell, man?
That is necessary for superconducting computers. So with this, you now can make a superconducting computer. Now, you're not going to have it on your desktop because it's still at super low temperatures, although ambient pressure.
Well, liquid nitrogen.
Liquid
level.
Nitrogen temperature. Yeah. So it is at
Which
a temperature.
Cheap.
Yeah. So you can have it in a server farm, you know, and superconducting computers are huge. That's a huge innovation.
Yeah.
When you think about the amount of electricity, the amount of electricity being used to run server farms now is like the electricity output needed to run countries, you know? And this could make a significant impact on that. Yeah.
Oh, no. Here comes more Bitcoin. Great. Does that mean
NFTs
Bitcoin,
are here to stay?
Yeah, right.
Blockchain. And...
So, Kara, you were right. I should have.
I was rooting for you. Like, Bob, go with your gut, man.
You
don't
almost
gut.
Did, too.
I wanted you to do that. Here's the title of the paper. The Field-Free Josephson Diode in a van der Waals Heterostructure. That's the paper.
Right, and anyone would know.
Tell that to
is.
Brian for the next...
And the other bit is they were able to do it without a magnetic field, which apparently is important. You know, so they demonstrated, a magnetic field, that they could have one-directional superconductivity using this so-called quantum 2D material. So, again, will this turn into superconducting supercomputers in 5 years or 10 years? Who knows, but it could. This was something that we've not been able to do before, and now they were able to do. So, and not only that, they thought it was impossible before they did it. Some physicists,
even better, thought
this could be impossible. There may be no way to do that, but they figured out a way to do it.
Man, I'm just realizing I almost picked this one. It was like a coin flip for me.
Yeah, I know.
I even said it out loud, and then I was like, so I'll go with NASA.
Yeah, I know. I didn't know which way you were going to go.
Oh, my God.
So cool.
Myself.
And this cool. is That's the awesome. Kind cool. of stuff you'll read about in our book, because it's all super cool. Right, but there's so many jigs and jags and left turns. I think we're trying to predict the next step. You know, even just I said, if you can predict the next step in one technology, you could become a billionaire. Now try to predict the next 20 steps in 1,000 technologies. That's the future.
AI and 3D printing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we definitely talk a lot about those.
Can't go too far wrong with those predictions.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
This week's quote was suggested by a listener, Jamie, from Wellington, New Zealand.
Wellington.
We've been to Wellington. Wonderful place. Jamie says, while reading the excellent book, Thinking to Some Purpose, written by Lizzie Susan Stebbing in 1939, I came across the following, which is as relevant today as it was in 1939. Here's the quote. There is an urgent need today for the citizens of a democracy to think well. It is not enough to have freedom of the press and parliamentary institutions. Our difficulties are due partly to our own stupidity, partly to the exploitation of that stupidity, and partly to our own prejudices and personal desires.
Could have been written today.
Heck, absolutely. Yes. And thank you. Why didn't I know about this book before? It must go on my to-buy list. Thinking to some purpose.
1939.
Well, yeah, but maybe.
It's a bit reassuring, though, isn't it, though, that things were that bad back then, you know, maybe, and we obviously survived, you know.
On the cusp, World War on the just around the corner.
But it's
absolutely true, absolutely true. And I think that's one of the things that really hit me over the head in the last 4 or 5 years. It's that I naively thought that the institutions themselves would protect us. You have democracy of everything, you know, but they don't. They absolutely don't.
Not enough.
It's like we all have to have a ladies and gentlemen's agreement for these institutions to work.
Yeah,
we have to want them to work and pull our weight.
And that means you have to do the maintenance work of democracy, which means protecting the quality as well as the freedom of the press and things like that. You know, and when those things deteriorate, when you have too many people believing in conspiracy theories and outlandish things, then democracy falls apart.
Right, and when you have leadership sowing that distrust.
The system only works when the voters hold elected officials accountable to some point. Mm-hmm. But if there's zero accountability, elected leaders become shameless and the system collapses. And that's what we're seeing. We're not past the point of no return yet. Some people think we are. I don't think we are. But
right. What was I watching the other day? Did you guys see the Uber series? The dramatization of Uber with Joseph Gordon-Levitt?
No.
How was it?
So it was good. He very unlikable character because I think apparently very unlikable guy. But there's a scene where he's talking about being this disruptor and he wants to break the system and blah, 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 like all the stuff you usually hear. And the guy from Friday Night Lights who plays Kyle Chandler, who plays the VC who funded him, is talking about how the disruptors very often can't become the leaders. Like he's saying, Uber is my thing and I need to be the leader. They're trying to take him out of the company. And he's like, revolutionaries never make good democratic leaders. Revolutionaries always become dictators. And it was such an, he was like, name me one time. Like they do good work, but then they have to step down.
George Washington's probably the only example I can think of.
Right.
He stepped down and could have been a dictator.
That was a very unique part in history.
It
where you had a group of leaders all steeped in the Age of Enlightenment. It was just like the perfect storm of things happening then. I don't think you can extrapolate that to many other
times. Right, and it doesn't translate to any other examples.
It's an outlier.
Yeah, it's an outlier. It's an absolute
interesting. Anyway.
All right. Well, interesting show, guys.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was very cool. Good topics.
Yeah. Learned a lot.
And thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Sure, man. Don't you ever ask me to do this again.
Well, next week, right?
Don't forget about the Friday live stream, Friday at 5 p.m. Eastern time. You can watch us streaming on the interwebs. So check it out. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.